Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we create our own tier list in East Conference. Who's in the S tier? Who's in the F tier? We talk about it for each conference. We have some discussions about some teams that we disagree with. We then talk about some players that are intriguing us. Victor Wembanyama and how teams are dealing with him defensively. All of the Ja Morant stuff. He may be available. Who makes sense for him? We bounce around there. And finally, we close with some unrivaled thoughts. Chelsea Gray's insane. De'Aaron Hamby's insane. Kelsey Plum is insane. A lot of double big lineups. Some fun takeaways from the weekend. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. I'm ready to talk some hoop. Nikias.
We're going to have some fun talking hoop today, Steve. We got a little bit of a theme today. Shake things up a little bit as we enter the early stages of January basketball. We're going to tier list, Steve. We are ranking these teams in the NBA, all 30. We're putting them in tiers. We have your S tier, your A tier on down the line. We're going to do it for both conferences just to kind of get a gauge on where we're at with everyone. And so we're going to start with the Western Conference as we get into this. But interesting stretch we've hit. I feel like we got a healthy sample size of what these teams have done on both ends. We factor in injury context and things like that. I'm excited to see how similar we are with these lists, where we may diverge in thought and be able to talk through it. I'm excited for this one, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to build on the most fun time of the year. This is my favorite stretch of basketball. When we get past the holidays and we're kind of towards that sprint towards the All-Star break and shave off a week before the All-Star break, because that's my PSA. Things will happen during then. Do not be surprised by results. But you see it every single night. I mean, we're coming off a night where Utah goes to Cleveland and beats Cleveland. The Pacers beat Boston. The Kings beat the Lakers. Like, this is that time of year where you need to figure out who you are. And I think it gets really tricky and it's fun to evaluate, because you mentioned we have a good sample size, right? We also have to deal with success comes the assumption that it will continue. And a higher sample size is going to allow you to kind of have more evidence on the team. So your bad play can linger because of scouting, because a team may say, hey, you're in a bad way. We're going to keep you slow. We're going to keep you, you know, pressure on you to turn the ball over. We're going to put you in tough spots. And that can get tricky. The quote-unquote bad teams always have a path. And the people that work for the bad teams know that. If we may not be all of that, but if we can do X, Y, and Z, we have a shot. That's where it gets tricky. So I want to check in, because if you look at the Eastern Conference standings, right, separation kind of exists. But there is not a single team in the top 10 that has won more than 6 out of their last 10 games.
Ooh, that's a fun one.
They're going through. Yeah. So this is where it gets really fun to kind of find out and balance. Okay, things are starting to shake in place, but now, you know, the Knicks that were knocking on the one seed are now looking and seeing the Celtics knocking on the three seed, or not knocking on the two seed. And now you kind of see the up and down, the back and forth. For me, and this is the fun part about the tiers, and I'll ask you this question: how do you judge a contender at this stage of the season? How do you start to slot people out during this stretch?
I think for me, there's a basic level of what do you do offensively? How do you want to win on that end? How many different ways can you win on that end? Defensively, what do you want to do? How many ways can you win on the defensive end? And as we kind of both alluded to, we do have a certain sample of, okay, this is what they want to do. This is how successful they are. When they have to pivot, this is what it looks like. Now, as we get into some of the advanced scouting, and the second time we face this team, the third time we face this team, okay, we're starting to see some counters now. How are we dealing with that? So it's kind of just kind of building the backlog for like playoff prep a little bit there. So I just kind of see there is a certain level of play I want to see on both ends of the floor. Or if you are elite offense, middling defense, like, okay, what level is middling defense? How do you get there? Those kind of things.
Well, I think it's finding out who a team is and then building out to see how do they handle their flaws. Is this a consistent flaw, or is this something they're having to work through and manage through? So if you're looking at the Eastern Conference, okay, Boston, all of a sudden their offense is in a place that no one expected it to be in. Okay, is it the defense? Can that offense maintain? What happens if that offense goes backwards? The Knicks, we praise the offense and the flow they found. Defensively, hey, what is this? Can you handle this portion of the program? And then what's it look like against different matchups? And I guess for me, as I was kind of building the tiers out, some of it was who this team is and what they've shown to be, but it's also what they could be. They could level up when it comes to the playoffs. And what could they do against certain teams? Can they find a way and have the versatility to kind of navigate through different matchups? So I feel like that part gets really interesting. How important is it to you, Nikias, to be able to level up in the playoffs to a degree? And I ask that because I go back to the Pacers last year where I was like, hey, this offense is this. I know how we feel about the defense, but in a playoff setting, it should be able to scale up. Does that play for you?
It does play for me, but again, I more so lean on what is your foundation, because I think depending on how strong it is, it makes it easier to believe in kind of the alternate path. If we have this certain level, it's easier to foresee, okay, if they add this on top of it, then here's where the run can come in. I think to your Pacers example, that's where the defense was leveling up for a few months before we got into that playoff run. We talked about it on this pod. It was like the December to February stretch, like, hey, the Pacers, slow start. They've kind of been flirting around a top 10 defense for a while. And so then when you get to the postseason and like the full court pressure is really popping and some of the scheme versatility is really popping in addition to what they were doing on the other end, it's like, oh, okay. It's easier to see how they made their run. It wasn't as surprising for us because we had already seen, okay, here are the elements that are kind of perking up.
No, I totally understand that. And I think for me to build off that, the base is really important. But my eyebrows do get raised by, ooh, what could you be in this setting? For example, Orlando, I've been stuck on all season because I feel like they will be a better playoff team than a regular season team because I think their defense will level up. I think they've been committed to offense and they got to figure it out. But what's it look like in the fourth quarters? Have you had success against the teams you need to? Can that travel with you? So there's questions and things where you can kind of level up and figure things out. A team like Cleveland, is it positioning that holds them back? Is it inconsistency that holds them back? Does a playoff series fix that? A team like Miami, hey, you're having a rough stretch, but you stay committed offensively. Who are you? It gets interesting. So I figured I would ask that as we went into the tiers. It was fun because I am usually the person who believes in all these teams can make a run just because in my brain, I'm like, I can see how they, I wouldn't be surprised by it. But it's intriguing. Is there a point in the season where you stop shifting teams between tiers?
That's probably funny enough, like January is where I kind of set my initial markers, like, okay, we have seen this stuff. Now let's see how it extends. And then once you get into March, which is a very controversial month for NBA analysis, apparently, once you get into that, that's where it's just like, okay, we're past the trade deadline. So if there's any kind of move you're going to do to shore up anything, we're past that now. We're getting past the like the buyout market deadline and things like that. Let's see what that part is going to look like. And then it's just how healthy are you? So like once you hit March, that's where I'm trying to finalize, okay, these are the teams that I actually believe can make a run. These are the teams that have to have two or three things go right before they make a run. These are the teams that, okay, I have seen to your earlier point, Steve, here's a flaw that stood out in October. It stood out in December. It stood out in February. It's still happening. I just don't think you're going to correct it. So that's kind of where I ended. What about you?
I would stay open-minded. Like, I think that I can, for me, the job is to understand what makes this team really good. What does this team struggle with? How do they counter it? Can they figure it out? Is there something that will take them over the top? And so for me, it's like, okay, what's your path? If you can elevate this part of your team, does that now enable you to go on a run? While understanding, hey, if you know, your margin for error is slim because the defense is only this good, or the offense gets slowed down against these type of teams, or you're going to struggle with this matchup. But if you find the right matchups and you're able to kind of navigate through the journey, I can understand it. Like in the Eastern Conference, there's not many teams I would be surprised if they made a conference finals run. It might be like, wow, how'd they do that? But, oh, they got hot on top of this, and that. Gets interesting. Mm-hmm.
Okay, understood. All right. Well, let's start with the West, Steve. We're going to start with the S tier. I'll start with my list. I have one team in the S tier. I don't know if that's controversial based on what has been recently for the Oklahoma City Thunder, but they are still 33-7 as a recording, per clean of the glass, fifth in offense, first in defense by a mile, first in net rating. They are the only team in the NBA with a double-digit positive net rating right now per clean of the glass. It's still plus 14, so we're still in historical air right now. And so it's hard for me, even with this recent stretch of play that we've talked about, by the way. We've acknowledged what the impact of Isaiah Hartenstein being out of the lineup means for them on both ends of the floor, how he impacts their flow in the half court offensively, the matchups he could take on defensively and the coverage that he could execute there. We've talked about Jalen Williams as he works back from the wrist. How important is the shot making going to be for him? How deeply and how often is he driving to the basket? What kind of advantages is he creating? So, like, there are fair things to ask about with this Thunder group. But if we have a 40-game sample of them basically being like a 70-win, playing on a 70-win pace, like, it's hard for me to drop them down too heavily. Like, I want to acknowledge what's been happening. And I'll say once again, like, it's worth keeping an eye on Shea. It's worth keeping an eye on the defense as a whole when some guys are missing. But as teams have gotten more and more comfortable or more willing to put Shea Gildas-Alexander in action, I go back to the end of that Phoenix game to where, hey, let's get the switch. Let's see what he does. You get him matched up against Devin Booker. Booker's able to get to a spot. Help is shown. There's an open shot created. You put Shea Gildas-Alexander in action once again. Do you want to switch? Do you want to switch and show help? He hangs there with Devin Booker, but it's still a shot that he can get to. That's still draining the legs a little bit of Shea, putting him in action that often. You get to this one, Lu Dort is like, well, I don't really want you in this matchup. I'm actually going to try to recover all the way back out to Devin Booker. It ends up being a foul. And so can everyone put Shea in a blender or embarrass him? Like, no, absolutely not. Do I think Shea has been a bad defender? No. But it goes back to the conversation that we had a couple of weeks ago, Steve, after the Spurs matchups, where I'm like, hey, are these Spurs-specific issues, or are more teams going to try to take some stuff? That's where putting Shea in action was interesting. That's where the switching that we saw against OKC in that Charlotte matchup, that was interesting. Things to worry about, or wonder about, rather, but they're still number one for me. They're still very much in the S tier. Is that fair, or do you think more teams should be in that tier, or they should be dropped down?
No, the champs deserve a tier of their own, so I put them up there by themselves. The curiosity factor comes for me with the next tier as far as teams, because my tier also has Oklahoma City by itself. Now, only you, Nikias Duncan, and I mean this appreciatively, would take a tier list functionality and turn that into, hey, can Shea guard these actions talk?
It's for me, it's trying to balance. I understood. Like, I just wanted to balance, hey, the Thunder are still dominant overall, and I want to lose sight of that while also acknowledging people are bringing things up for valid reasons. And so just trying to balance the two. That's all it is. But you also have Okay, fair enough. All right, well, as we get into the A tier, since we both have the Spurs, we both have the Thunders in the S tier. For me, Steve, I have the Nuggets, I have the Wolves, I have the Spurs in the A tier. Teams that I could very well see a conference finals appearance. Teams that I think in different ways match up pretty well with OKC, or at the very least they have things that they can poke at against the Thunder if they match up in a series. And so wouldn't surprise me if they were able to knock off OKC. Again, I have them favored. I think they're the best team in the league. But I could see any of those three teams posing issues for OKC in representing the West in the finals. Is that a fair assessment of those three? Or do you agree with those three teams?
Well, spoiler alert, as my tier screen had popped up, I also had those three teams in the A tier as far as their ability to make a run in the Western Conference. Now, the interesting part is the reasoning behind it could get interesting. I had a quick thought, do I put the Spurs in the S tier because the Oklahoma City Thunder have not been able to beat them? But balancing out, have the Spurs been able to separate from everyone else in the Western Conference to that degree? Uncertain there. So the Spurs deserve respect, and the defense has been really good. They've showcased that they can do it. Now they have to do it consistently. Denver stays here because of what we've seen at the start of the season with their connectivity, with the play of Jokic, with Murray, with the emergence of Aaron Gordon. That kind of keeps them up there for me, because at the high end, I know what they could be offensively. The defense feels at least a little more versatile to be able to navigate through the playoffs. That's fantastic. Minnesota, some could say it's because they've done it the last 2 years, but they are rolling. They know who they are. There's a self-awareness with that group. And with Anthony Edwards playing this way, you get enough of the defense. The offense has more improvements. That's something that feels like it could be stronger in the playoffs. Now, the question mark becomes, with these teams, how much of this is, I believe they could get there, or I believe they could beat the Oklahoma City Thunder?
I think it is more of the latter for me. Or more for the former for me. Like, I think that they can get there. I think all three of those teams are very good. All of them have, like, a no doubt about it superstar in the mix. And so once you get into a playoff setting, he destroys worlds. There's only so much you can do. If Anthony Edwards destroys worlds, there's only so much you can do. Nikola Jokic, still, for my money, is the best player in the NBA. So naturally, if he destroys worlds, there's only so much you can do. But again, there's so much depth. There's so much defense for OKC, especially at the high end, that I still just have that level of belief in them. They will be favored in any series for me against either of those three teams. But to your earlier point, pathways are absolutely there. I actually wanted to ask you a question about the Spurs, since they were the team that I struggled most with between, like, to your point, S-tier argument, because they have beat the Oklahoma City Thunder and posed very specific problems to them. They land in the A-tier for me. And then a little bit lower as I kind of look at what this offense has been since those Thunder matchups. On the high end, you have De'Aaron Fox that can create advantages, and Stephon Castle, and Devin Vassell, who's been out for a little bit at this point, but Dylan Harper. They have ways to score and to drive and to generate advantages. But you can throw unders at a lot of these guys. You can throw switches at a lot of these guys. We've had conversations about not just how are we getting Wimby the ball, but where are we getting it to him? How quickly are we getting it to him? And so, like, I have been intrigued by what that part looks like. And something that perked up for me a week ago at this point, when we got to the Spurs-Grizzlies matchup, it was the first time that I remember seeing a team intentionally putting a big on Stephon Castle just outright, not just switching or transition matchups. Jaren, you just have the Stephon Castle matchup. And to see the Spurs try to work with that, opening possession of the third quarter, the first quarter rather, you get Stephon Castle curling off screens, he gets downhill. But as the as time went on, let's try to go on pick and roll. Jaren Jackson Jr. goes early. Let's put Stephon Castle in the dunker spot. Jaren's at the rim, and that's muddying up driving lanes. They go to Chicago action on this clip. Jaren's ducking under all of it. It's a pull-up three that you're daring Stephon Castle to make. And as good as he's been this year, and as good as I believe he's going to be moving forward, the jump shot still hasn't really gotten there, or at the very least, the pull-up three hasn't gotten there. So as I'm projecting forward for the Spurs in the postseason, I am kind of curious about what the guard play is going to look like. I think we both acknowledge how good it can be and how impactful it is on the high end. But if the shooting isn't there, because quiet is kept, De'Aaron Fox hasn't been knocking down shots since Christmas either, at least from the perimeter. It's like, huh. Sorry, do you have any concerns about the Spurs offense at all? Or is this just kind of like weird stretch of the season? They're going to be fine. You have high level of belief.
No, they have 48 minutes of consistent guard play. I think for Dylan Harper, the drives have been there. You'd like to see everything else around it pop. But the fact that they have Wembanyama playing at this level and they have the guard play and the understanding of who they are, I'm not as concerned. And so it's good for them to get these reps against switches and try and figure things out. Yeah, so I mean, I think the Spurs have earned enough of the respect going forward to kind of put themselves, they've played their way into that tier, especially with the defense of Wembanyama. Now, what got me thinking was the B tier and the difference that we both had. I believe we both had the Rockets up there. I had the Los Angeles Lakers still up there because at some point, even if the defense has been what it's been, it's not going to be fun to try and guard Luka Doncic, LeBron James, and Austin Reeves in a playoff series. I still believe that could push them forward. You, on the other hand, have the Phoenix Suns in the B tier, and I'm curious as to how we arrived on that. Is this more the Suns have played at a high level, or are we concerned with the Los Angeles Lakers?
I think my answer to that, honestly, Steve, is yes. I think the Suns have just kind of earned their way to this. Like, they have been a very good defense all year long. And when healthy, they have proven we have multiple ball handlers. We have multiple screeners. We space well. We cut well. Our big man room has really been impactful. We can throw different looks at you. We can do some hub work with Oso Iguodaro. We can go more traditional pick and roll or just stash Mark Williams in the dunker spot. So, like, the Suns are just a good team on both ends of the floor. And so, like, I just think 8-2 since Christmas, they're the best defense in the league since Christmas. They're just there. To the Lakers' point, Austin Reeves is out. They've had their injury stuff. I'm just so disillusioned with this defense. It's hard for me to have belief beyond they can carve out some regular season wins. Like, this is not the profile of a team that is 23-14. Like, of the teams we've talked about, they're the only ones with a negative point differential, if you care about that. Like, I'm sorry, like, Luka is excellent. I do have some questions about, like, what types of advantages and what types of shots he's getting to, but that could be a conversation for a little bit later. And the defense is just not good enough for me to have them any higher than where they're at. I can't put them in the Rockets or the Suns tier right now.
Would you argue that the Rockets' offensive woes are in a similar boat?
I could argue it. Yes, I think that is fair. And the Rockets were a tough team for me to place as well. Cause I was like, ooh, can I put them in the A tier? Cause I think they are still like, they have the second best point differential in the West overall this year. But to your point, they are in a historically bad run of three-point shooting right now. I think that is going to course correct. They have missed Alperen Şengün for a little bit. He just came back. I think they can work out more things with the offense, with the personnel that they have, than the Lakers can with their current personnel defensively. So that's probably where I would kind of see it.
Now, this is where it gets interesting for me. I'm less concerned about the defense purely because I believe in a playoff setting, there's a game plan element that you can add to your team that can put you in a different position, put you in a different spot, and kind of help, you know, put you in an area where, okay, our base may not be as good, but we know exactly what we want to do defensively, and that would be my expectation. I think where it gets interesting for me with the Rockets is I don't think this is an absolute, hey, they're done. Their defense is entirely too good. Kevin Durant is too good offensively. They have a decisiveness in the half court when they're humming that works well, and they can control tempo. So I think both teams have enough elements to put themselves in good position. Now, the tricky part for both of them is it's a lot different when you are now in the 6-7 range as opposed to the 3-4-5 range. And so that changes your path. And that, to me, is more important than the pure, hey, they're going through it portion. Because if you fall to that play-in or you fall to that 60, that's a tough, tough path to navigate as opposed to, you know, having some of the home court. So it's just, can they balance out the start, and put themselves back in a high position?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. Are you ready to move to the next tier of teams, Steve? I'm curious if we had more agreement here. So I think for me, as we get back to the Western Conference tiers, you mentioned we disagreed a little bit on the Suns and the Lakers. But I had the Lakers and the Warriors in the C tier, where they have very obvious top tier talent. Luka Doncic, LeBron James, Austin Reeves when he comes back for the Lakers. You have Stephen Curry, and you have Jimmy Butler, who's somehow having an under-radar very good season. I think there is understandable frustration with, hey, here's a night we kind of need you to drop 30. You have 17 for us. Can you please be more aggressive in these winter months? But he's having a good year. Defense is strong. The offense has been inconsistent. There's kind of in a weird place for me. In the D tier, though, Steve, I have the Blazers, who are perking up. We talked about them last week. The Clippers, also talked about recently. Continue to perk up. Kawhi Leonard, James Harden, they've been incredible. And the Memphis Grizzlies, who just serve as like one of the weirder teams in the West, because depending on what night I catch them on, they are humming and moving the ball and anyone can initiate, and Cam Spencer's knocking out all these threes and Jaren is driving and it's cool. Then on other nights, the defense just isn't there and none of it matters. So like the D tier, I wouldn't be surprised if in a month I'm moving the Clippers up if they continue this run, because they certainly have like the top end talent to do so. But they're in that play-in mix. They're all kind of interesting to me. How would you rank the play-in teams right now, actually?
Well, I would rather prefer to reveal my tier real quick.
Oh, you know,
as far as that goes. So the C tier, I have the Suns down there. I have the Warriors and I have the Blazers. Now, the Suns probably have a right to play their way up into the B tier because of the defense and the consistency they've had offensively with Devin Booker. The Warriors, Stephen Curry's been insane. I don't know where the defense is going to come from. And with the positioning they're in, you're kind of locked into, boy, we win, we get to play Wemby. We lose and we win, we get to play the Thunder. And that's just not ideal.
It's not, so for me, it's like,
you've played your way into that position. For me, the Blazers, humming a little bit. And so I'm intrigued what Jrue Holiday does to boost them. So I gave them a respect. The D tier is a bunch of teams where I'm like, yeah, sure. Maybe like that. It's not, I believe in the Clippers and we've talked about them on this podcast. The problem is the record. And so you have to be so insanely good to put yourself in a position. And then that good will earn you the right to face the Oklahoma City Thunder. And so I have a hard time with that. I have a tough deal with that. For Memphis, the inconsistency has been the inconsistency. Utah, please defend at some point. Dallas Mavericks, injuries. And so that's kind of where I'm at.
Okay. Understood. The Clippers 8-2 in their last 10 games, second in offense, 12th in defense. They are perking up, but that slow start for them really put them in a hole, to your point. So we'll see where they land in terms of the playoff conditioning there. And then from there, like we have similar teams in that tier at the bottom. The Pelicans, the Kings. Interesting young talent across both teams, especially on the New Orleans side, but it's tough sledding. The record kind of is what it is. The point differential is kind of what it is. I am curious to see what moves, if any, are made. I imagine good teams are going to come calling. There's already been rumblings. Hey, we would like Trey Murphy or we like Herb Jones. And the Pelicans saying absolutely not. The Kings have some vets that could be useful elsewhere. So it's worth keeping an eye on that. But that is where I'm at. Those are the two teams I affectionately have in the Kings tier because they're not winning games right now. There's reason for upside, not winning games right now.
Understood. This does not help your allegations against Pelicans. I have those two in my F tier as well, but I will say they're not going to be fun teams to face during this stretch because you catch the Kings on the wrong night. It's a tough game in the fourth quarter. And they have bucket getters. Yeah. Like, don't forget that portion.
They do. So,
it's been a lot, but they can catch you on the right night.
Ask the Lakers, ask the Rockets. I think that's fair. Okay. We are going to take a quick break. And when we return, we are going to go through our Eastern Conference tiers as of today. We are back with this episode of The Dunker Spot. Steve, it is time to run through the Eastern Conference. We will start again with my list. We start with the S tier, Steve. In the West, we had the Thunder by themselves. They earned a little bit of separation. In the East, it's a little bit more jumbled up for me. Three teams in the S tier. And honestly, I considered as I was building this out that we just didn't have an S tier. But I was like, okay, well, we can't do that. I don't want to start from A and then add another letter and all that good stuff. So in the S tier, your East leading Detroit Pistons, quietly 4-4 since Christmas Day, 17th in offense. We talked about some of the half court things, but 28-10, second best defense in the league. The defense has been outstanding all year long. Kate Cunningham has been outstanding. The Boston Celtics also in this S tier with the winning that they've been able to do, sans Jason Tatum. The New York Knicks remained in the S tier, but as you've already alluded to before, got to see where this defense is. Is it fair to have these three teams rushed up? Steve, who is in your S tier?
My S tier only has two teams. It has the Detroit Pistons, because I respect the run that they've been on, the identity they've built, the consistency they've had all year, and it has the New York Knicks. Now, I debated putting the Pistons by themselves in the S tier to respect their start. The Knicks get up there because of their playoff potential. I think what they've done offensively, and when Josh Hart is out there, they're just humming at a good level. They have to figure out what they want to do defensively, and they do have some defensive questions as far as, you know, Jalen Brunson, Karl Anthony Towns in action together. What's that going to look like? Do we have enough of a base to navigate that? But I just think they have an upside in the playoffs that could push them towards that tier that other teams may not have. So those are my two S-tier teams.
Okay. So then the immediate question I'd ask as we flow into the A tier, because I had Boston in the S tier, you did not. What is keeping you from having Boston a little bit higher?
I think for me with the Celtics, what does it look like against a playoff game plan? Not that Jaylen Brown hasn't played well, not that Derek White hasn't played well, not that Anfernee Simons hasn't played well, not that Peyton Pritchard hasn't played well. Those are the people taking the bulk of the shots. And so if I'm coaching against the Celtics, as good as that offense has been, as much as they compete defensively, I just got to take one of those people off the table. And if I can put you in a scenario where your offense is not at this level, how much of an impact is that going to have? Is your defense going to be able to maintain? Can I put you in a box? So that keeps them from the S tier for me, as opposed to with a Detroit, could have the same concerns, but that defense is at such a high level, you trust it in the playoffs. Knicks, you may have the same concerns about the defense. Jalen Brunson's a whole lot to deal with. We've seen that last year. So that's kind of where I was at more than anything else.
Okay. I think that's fair. Like, I think with Boston, again, they've won so much. One of the best, if not the best, point differential in the East. They're up there per cleaning the glass. They just got to get the defense to a certain level, and they are right there, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, not far off the 2 seed from the New York Knicks in both of those teams. Within striking distance of Detroit, again, there is still a little bit of a gap there. But any kind of run or any kind of slowdown from Detroit puts the 1 seed in a little bit more jeopardy. So we'll keep an eye on that. But okay, figured I'd get your thoughts there. I thought your answer was going to be illegal screen, Steve.
No, I'm not Joe Mazzulla.
Low-hanging fruit. That's Joe Mazzulla not pleased by the end of the Pacers game there. Pascal Siakam with the game winner there. Okay, let's move to the A tier. For me, Steve, three teams fill my A tier right now. It's all very much y'all are good, but also for me, in that tier for me, the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Philadelphia 76ers, and the Toronto Raptors. we are fresh off of getting to call Sixers Raptors. So if you haven't checked that game out from Monday night, check out the strategy stream option. Listen to Steve I give some live analysis. Quick plug there. But I just keep waiting for the Cavs to get there. Like, Darius Garland's looking more like himself. We talked about how great Donovan Mitchell has been overall this year, especially with all of the inconsistency around him. Jared Allen's had some flashes. Evan Mobley's been good, but hasn't made the leap. It's just like, what is going to pop for them? Is it going to be the offense that spearheads things, especially since Sam Merrill's been back? Will the defense get to a high enough level? But there's so much talent still there. I'm just kind of waiting on it. I think they're good. I think the second half of the season can be good for them as they build more chemistry. And the Sixers and Raptors are just fascinating basketball teams. Top-end talent, good defenses, can mismatch hunt at the end of games. I think they've earned their way to kind of that second tier in the East.
So I'm sensing a sliding scale with your tier list, Nikias, because I was trying to figure out how the Cavs get that high in the A tier, considering that we have not seen a consistent stretch, not that it can't elevate. Interesting that we both have the Sixers up there. And you have great respect for the Raptors. If you go to my A tier real quick, I only have the Sixers up there with the Celtics. And for me, with the Sixers, it's we're building something that is going to be tough to deal with in the playoffs. As far as being able to have the guard play of Maxey and Edgecombe, to be able to have Paul George get healthier, and then Joel Embiid is now bringing this all together to where we can execute in the half court. We have pressure points. We can keep it on you. That's a formula in the playoffs to me. So to me, that kind of puts them in the, hey, this could make a run if you get the right matchups. And so that's kind of where my A tier was. You can see as we flow into the B tier, that's kind of my, I would not be surprised, but you are going to have to do something very drastic as far as elevating a portion of the program. Like, I love what the Raptors have done. Is it going to be the defense being consistent? Is the offense going to have movement? Or are you going to get bogged down? The Magic, I remain high on their ability to be a problem in the playoffs, because if Franz Wagner and Paolo Banchero are healthy, they can attack matchups. They play with better tempo for the most part, and their defense can elevate. But we've yet to see consistently in clutch games, starting to get interesting. The Cavs, I respect what they've done with Mobley, with Mitchell, with Garland, with Allen. Just have to do it consistently. And I have to wonder, do you know who you are? And the Miami Heat, I think you know who you are. Do you understand what that means as you get to the stretch of the season? And you have, even during this losing stretch, positive stretches of basketball that get erased because, ooh, the drive's dried up, the defense dried up, oh, we're in a tough spot. Now, that B tier for me all has fixable issues.
Okay.
Areas of opportunity, as some would say.
Okay. I like that. So I think we're thinking about our B tiers in a similar vein. As we flip to mine, there's only a team difference there. Again, I had to wrap this up. And so for me in the B tier, have the Orlando Magic. You mentioned if Paolo's healthy, if Franz is healthy. I would also add if Jalen Suggs is healthy. He is just an important bellwether for them on both ends of the floor. Also, the Anthony Black level up is just happening in Orlando. And so that takes a little bit of pressure of Jalen Suggs coming back. But either way, having another guard in that room, and obviously Desmond Bane very good at basketball as well. You just want more consistency from him as well. They have a pathway with that defense and a little bit more offense and more pace, to your point. The Hawks and Heat are where I was in a headlock. As the Hawks have finally traded Trae Young, they are continuing, at least statistically, to defend at a high level in the games without Trae Young. Since Christmas Day, they have been almost a top five defense, which is funny to me, but we will leave that there in the interest of time. And the Miami Heat, like, they kind of have to be here by default for me. Like, I can't objectively say they are a bad basketball team. The defense has been in the top 10 all year long. The offense, when it hits, they knock down threes, they drive all over the place, they blitz and they poke at mismatches. There have been enough good games to where, like, okay, this is how it works when it works. Steve, after the hot start, they are down to 22nd in offense per cleaning the glass. And it's been too many, like, second halves of games where defenses are like, all right, well, actually, we're just going to show late help. We're going to switch all of this. We're going to show late help at the rim. Y'all aren't going to knock down threes. We're going to run on you. And now it just does not matter anymore. That has made me sad. Bam Adebayo, who's just very clearly playing compromised right now. And so I know there's the old adage, if you're on the court, you have to play better. And I think that's fair to an extent. He very clearly is just not himself on either end of the floor right now. That's made me sad. And ultimately, I zoom out with this Heat team. It's like, what does this mean? What does this even mean for them? 20-19 as a recording. What am I supposed to do with this? They're fine. Like, do I see them making an Eastern Conference Finals run with this group? I don't. Would it be the most shocking thing because they've laid out a pathway? Like, no, but I don't see it. I just don't like where they're at. I wasn't expecting this one. This is very funny.
Look at you, man. Look at you, man.
I'm just like, what am I supposed to do with this, man? What am I supposed to do with this Heat team right now?
The annual Nekias Duncan doesn't believe in the Miami Heat rant. That's what you're supposed to do because you do it every year.
And I think it's a problem that I can do this every year. Like, they don't have a pure number one guy. Like, it's at a certain point, this is where they've been like linked to John Morant. Like, I don't think they're actually going to do that. But at a certain point, you have to get someone.
Look at this.
And matter of fact, I think that was from the Heat Wolves game from a week or so ago, where once again, second half, just like, oh, they just cannot score anymore. And Minnesota took that game over. They play the top teams in the league and it gets tough. We just saw it against the Oklahoma City Thunder. It's like, oh, snap, look at this first quarter. Look at this first half. They're driving. They're scoring. And then the second half happens. And it's like, oh, right. They can't sustain that gear against the teams they're eventually going to have to beat if they want to go where they want to go with this group.
That's part of...
They're here because they're like not...
That's part of playing the game of basketball, though. So
it is.
They got to figure out how to find a way to sustain and be consistent against those top teams that have size, that have length, that contain the drives. That's what they have to figure out. And they will either figure it out and elevate back to where they were, or teams will continue to do that. Now, when they go on a winning streak, when they go on a winning streak and I come in here and say some things, I don't want to hear it from you or anybody else. Because this happens every year.
And then what happens, Steve? Like, to your point, they did this last year. They found some stuff. They get into the playoffs. They face Cleveland, and they end up suffering they have like the worst defensive performance in NBA playoff history in that first round series against Cleveland. Like, it's Dwayne Wade's on the wall. Like, I want them to do well, but like, it's they're fine. The Miami Heat, they fine.
So we're doing advanced stats with this team's a fraud, and I was right later. I understand it now.
Got it. I ain't say all that, but okay. That is
the
B-tier
for me. You basically gave a Twitter argument.
Gosh darn it. All right. Who do you have in your C tier, sir?
Just the Atlanta Hawks.
Okay.
Quality team. Trying to figure out who they are. Fine team, offensive team. Jalen Johnson's fun. CJ's going to fit in. Who are you beating? Who are you guarding?
Okay. Fair enough. C tier for me is just the Milwaukee Bucks. Because when they have Giannis Antetokounmpo available and when he is on the floor, they are a good team that can hang with just about anyone. When he is not available, you saw what the record was. When he goes to the bench, when he is available, they die. And so this is why they are linked to Michael Porter Jr. and Zach LaVine and a little bit of Ja Morant and insert high salary guy that is talented but flawed here, Jeremy Grant, et cetera. Like, they obviously want to add a little bit more to help Giannis out offensively and ultimately keep him in Milwaukee. I don't know what to do with this team overall. They have good players, obviously, an MVP caliber player still, but don't know how available he's going to be. And ultimately, when he's not on the floor or directly involved in action, I just don't know what they're going to be. And the defense has not found itself to a degree that I thought they would head into the year. So they're in the C tier, the Bulls in their own tier, the play-in invitational. They've had some interesting wins during this stretch since Josh Giddey and Kobe White have been out, but still not a good team overall. Also, enjoyed Matas Muzela's not only dunking on people, but also passing the ball a little bit. That's a fun development. But those are your two single team tiers for me. Who do you have in your D tier, Steve?
The Chicago Bulls, the Milwaukee Bucks, and the Charlotte Hornets are in the D tier. Bulls, get up and down, have fun. Don't know if you can sustain any of it. You win two, you lose two. It is what it is. The Bucks, it sure would be nice if y'all could play defense and have a base of defense that is consistent enough to be able to be like, okay, maybe you can't keep the ball in front, but I know you can help. Or, hey, maybe you're struggling to help, but I know you can recover. You have a cycle of issues defensively that is taking away from your offensive growth, and you got to figure that out pretty quickly. Charlotte Hornets are very fun. I will give them that. That elevated them up a tier for me. I found it interesting. You had a Kangs tier in the East as well. Now, I'm not the most well-spoken tier fellow, but how's that work?
You know, the honest answer, I thought that would just be a funny bit if I wanted to have a team below that. Okay. So we're just going to put them there. So that's what that was going to be. The Hornets and the Nets are two teams I have enjoyed watching this season, as you are well aware of. Also, funny bit, because of the absolute beatdown they gave to the Utah Jazz, since Christmas Day, Steve, your Charlotte Hornets, second best point differential in the NBA now since December 25th, largely off the strength of that. Now, they've also had some quality wins in that stretch as well. But like that one in particular, when you hang 150 on a group, that's going to skew some of the numbers. But they've been flirting around a top 10 offense for large portions of the season, even before the Utah game. When they have LaMelo, Conkin, Nipple, Brandon Miller on the floor, they can poke at matchups. They're one of the more underrated double drag teams in the league. LaMelo can score, Conk can score, Brandon Miller can get busy. So, like, they're interesting. The Brooklyn Nets, thank you for giving me, like, the month and a half of defense. Last couple weeks, don't want to talk about it. But still a fun group. Michael Porter Jr. rumors swirling around once again. Teams want to send that first and stuff for him. We'll see if they actually want to move him. But
Would you like to repeat that, kind sir? Because I personally distinctly remember a victory lap that took place. Is the race over? Stands cleared?
It's the race. I announced a while ago, like, I was technically incorrect with my bold prediction. I said, hey, through the first 2 or 3 months of the season, the Nets going to be a top 10 defense before leveling off. They start off historically bad. They then put together a month plus of top five defense. And now over this last couple of weeks, or since Christmas Day, they are 26th in defense. So we had to stretch. I was wrong. I said that early on. I was wrong. I was also happy that we did get an extended stretch. That was not quite a victory lap. A victory like jog, maybe? Like a we go midway around the track?
No, the run it back was just for their defense going back to where it probably was landing in the real place. The real thing is a bit aside with the victory lap, we did do a segment on the pod about the Brooklyn Nets defense. So, you know.
Yeah. We got it in when we could. And then the Kings tier, the Pacers, who were coming off of that win against the Boston Celtics. Just playing better overall. The defense is starting to perk up, but the record is the record. And the Washington Wizards, we haven't seen them with Trae Young yet. Interesting young talent. Alex Starr has been playing at a fringe all-star level pretty much all year long, if you want, like, the brightest spot in Washington. But yeah, the record is the record. The point differential is the point differential. So they deserve to be in that bottom tier. Did you have any disagreements there at the bottom?
No, I think I had the Nets with the Wizards and the Pacers. Very fun, but also it's not their fault. I've enjoyed watching all three of these teams play. It's been nice to see the way the Pacers win 3 games in a row and battle through and mix in small lineups and get back to being chaotic. And I think the guard play in Washington has been fun. And Brooklyn competes and will continue to move the ball. So all fun teams, just it's kind of where we're at right now.
All right. That is going to do it. Let us know how we did in the comment section. Give us your own tiers. We may talk about them a little bit later in the week, but I'm going to take a break here. And when we return, we have some player specific thoughts, some things that we're keeping an eye on. A little bit of a departure from our usual segment, but we will be back shortly.
The smartest NBA coverage on YouTube 5 days a week. Watch the Dunker Spot with Nikias Duncan and myself, bring you the elite X's and O's and film breakdowns that you won't get anywhere else. Kevin O'Connor with fantastic analysis and some sharp hoops conversations. And every week, Tom Haberstroh and Dan Devine will be breaking down the stats that define the league on the big number. Plus, fast daily NBA updates and trends from Dan Titus to keep you ahead of the timeline. If you love basketball, welcome home.
And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. And Steve, it is time to post up with some player thoughts, some player shout outs, some things that have intrigued the both of us as of late. We're going to start with you, Steve. Who would you like to talk about?
Me personally, I like to talk about Joel Embiid. Over his last 10 games, Nikias averaging 28.3 points, 8.4 rebounds, shooting 51% from the field. He scored 20 or more in 11 straight games. And I think the fascinating part here, the Raptors and Sixers coming off, playing back-to-back games against each other. And Embiid did not play in the first game. He did play in the second. And in that game, he reminded you of the impact he can have on a game in the half court. And what was interesting was kind of the back and forth between each team. The Raptors were smaller in that first game against Philly. Colin Murray-Boyce was really impactful. The team was able to switch. They're trying to contain the Sixers' drives, trying to show help. Joel Embiid comes back. And immediately, the Philadelphia 76ers are like, what are y'all going to do? So we're going to put ourselves in a position where we're going to post Joel Embiid up. And we're going to see what you're going to do. We're going to see if you're going to double team Joel Embiid. And they did. They were able to flow out of it. They were able to play out of it. And immediately after that, it put them in a position where, okay, how do we do it again? Another Embiid post up, got a double team. And now they're in a position because of the roster they have. Tyrese Maxey's able to drive a closeout. So that puts them in that position that makes it really tough. After that, they just put Joel Embiid in the middle of the floor and just decided, you know what? Don't worry about any of that. We're going to flow into this. We're going to run pick and roll. We're going to get him at the elbow. And you know what? Do you want to help? We can see everything and he can go to work. Helps when you make shots. But when you're able to kind of play with VJ Edgecombe and have some of that middle pick and roll game, it just makes it really tough. I think the patience that VJ has shown with Joel Embiid, the decisions you have to make as a defense, okay, if we're going to try and contain that drive, it just puts us in a tough spot. You know, playing with Tyrese Maxey in two-man game and understanding, hey, I have it going. You're trying to guard Maxey. I don't have to pop. I can get it right back to Tyrese. That opens things up for the Philadelphia 76ers in a way that's just a lot different. And so I like the fact that, yes, Embiid can have that impact. Yes, we can keep pressure on teams, but it doesn't have to necessarily be in just a post-up. We can generate open looks. We can generate positive shots. We can put ourselves in a good position with our guard play. So it was more so that Embiid was able to kind of just be so decisive that made things fun.
Okay, I like that. I like that. And again, we got to call that one live on Monday night, so check that out if you haven't already. So I guess the question I'll toss your way, Steve, is how sustainable do you think this is for Joel Embiid and zooming out for the Sixers overall?
Which part sustainable?
I guess just in general, the decisiveness and the efficiency in which he's doing this. Like, do you think this can just be him? I think there's always like the health concerns. There's also just the overall blend of how much Embiid versus how much Maxey versus how much PG, et cetera. Because we've seen it's perked up as a good.
Well, no, I don't see my concern is because the Sixers have a stronger base that it's not just we have to get Embiid going in the post. And now if Embiid's out, you two, you guys have to do this. So the fact that they were able to kind of get him to his spots within the flow of the offense was important to me. As opposed to, hey, it has to just be Joel Embiid's portion of the program. It's not walk it up, get him to him at the elbow. It's, okay, let's run a pick and roll and see if we can get it to it. And now they can play off of each other within that. So that's the part where I'm like, I think this is sustainable for everyone. You got to put it, you got to piece it together, and Embiid has to stay on the court and produce. But when he's able to do that, I think it's tough to deal with the Sixers because now we can execute in the half court. We can keep pressure on him.
Okay, no, that's fair. That's what, again, just asking more so about the overall sustainability of piecing all of that together. I think all of that is fair. And we got to see, obviously, obviously elements of that last night against Toronto. So, fun stuff on that front. Steve, we have more rumblings with Ja Morant. And this feels a little bit more real than what we've gotten as of late from Shams Charania. Kind of breaking out over the last couple of days, the Grizzlies now more open to entertaining offers for Ja Morant, which is a departure from Ja's our guy. We still believe in him. Don't even call us about him. He's not going anywhere. I think Zach Kleiman has been very intentional about his wording concerning Ja Morant over the past couple of seasons, as you know, has been on the floor as much, some of the off-court issues and things. There's still been that belief level that we've gotten this shift is interesting to me. And I don't really know what to do with it. Because we are fresh off of the Trae Young deal, where it was clear the Hawks did not want to commit like max level money to Trae Young, and they weren't sure if they wanted to continue building around him as like the overall point of the offense. And we eventually land on the Washington trade. And so even as you're thinking of like Ja Morant suitors, one's just off the board from in the Washington Wizards since they just traded for Trae Young. But like Ja in particular, I have been frustrated with some of the play. Where, hey, you have a driving lane here, you are not taking it, or you are now taking these open pull-up jumpers, you're just not hitting enough of them. But then there are also games where, go back to the Grizzlies-Sixers game not too long ago, where Ja Morant is in command. He is getting to his spots, he's attacking early and often. The playmaking pops because of the advantages he's able to create. Just kind of see he still has like this all-NBA ceiling to him to where he can dictate terms. And so he's obviously, in my opinion, still a very good player. It's hard to get to star or superstar right now because of where the shooting is and because of where the floater is. I do think just as a small guard, and it's something that I broached with you as we were talking about Trae Young, the margins do shrink figuratively and literally when you are a small guard. Like, there is just a scoring threshold that you have to hit to make that worth it, especially if you're not going to be a high level defender. And John Morant, he's had his stretches of engagement. He's had his stretches of event creation throughout his career, but he's never firmly been a good defender. And so, like, it's hard to kind of parse through what his trade value is right now. And so on a basic level, I am curious to see, like, how this ends. And that's why it was interesting to me that Shams immediately followed up that tweet. We're getting phone calls and offers, but we are also okay with keeping him, which is a signal to me, like, we are not selling low on him. If you want him, you got to give me something good. And so I'm just in a weird place with Ja and with the Grizzlies in general, because they are, I tweeted this the other day, they're a fascinating team. Depending on what night you catch them, the defense is good. They run in transition. Literally anyone can initiate their offense. You have Cam Spencer, threes all over the place. Jalen Wells perked up offensively after a really cold start. Vince Williams was doing some ball handling while Ja was out. That's continued. Cedric Howard, as you've written about in the rookie review or in your rookie rankings, and just generally following the Grizzlies, like, there are good things that can happen on any given night. The consistency is where it dings, and you would like to see Ja be an answer to that, but he hasn't been super available. So I'm just curious to see where this goes. Like, I don't blame Memphis for exploring things. It's, but I would imagine Miami, Brooklyn, Minnesota, probably the three teams at the top of mind for me at the very least, that'll sniff around this. But I'm just in an odd place with Ja and with the Grizzlies as a whole.
I think you cannot put the toothpaste back in the tube. It's a life lesson. Once certain thresholds are crossed, once you put yourself in a certain position, once there's a feeling of resentment, and it's hard to go back. And so I truly believe it's over. It's done. John Morant's going to be the next domino to fall. He's going to get traded. And so it's just kind of the nature of the beast. Because how do you bring him back into the fold after the incident? And hey, just so you know, we're willing to trade him.
Mm-hmm.
We can do the math.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, that being out there is a signal in and of itself. And so that's where, I guess I'll toss the question to you, Steve. Like, what team makes the most sense for Ja if the Grizzlies do actually press that button before the deadline or heading into the offseason?
Well, I think this is the tough part about midseason trades, because of a lot of teams are battling and competing and playing well. I'd probably say Miami more so than Minnesota for me. I don't necessarily think Minnesota needs to make that swing with the run that they've had and what they've found offensively and what they can do defensively and the ceiling that they've produced. Not to say he wouldn't help Minnesota. I just don't necessarily think that they have to do that. I think for Miami, if you can get Ja Morant for the right price, right pieces, why not? You add another talent. You get someone who drives the basketball well. I know people will make jokes about, well, he didn't like the offense. I think he'll be fine getting downhill and working with Eric Spoelstra, who's known to get the best out of his players. So I'd probably circle Miami. Not sure if it happens, but Brooklyn, I don't see it. I don't see Brooklyn making that as their first move and swing for the future.
Okay. Like, the Brooklyn one is where I was interested, because obviously they have the assets to pull it off, and they have the cap space to pull it off. But it would be interesting to draft, like, three guards, and then a few months later, it's like, hey, let's go ahead and get Ja Morant. Actually, we just don't believe in any of these guys, or at the very least, we don't believe in them enough to not explore this. So that does feel kind of odd to me. The Miami one, I feel like starting to come around on, because I was generally in the I don't really love the fit, especially if Ja getting to the rim a ton early in his career that has tailed off because of some of the injuries and some of the scheme changes and how teams guard him, something that we talked about when we had our big Memphis conversation earlier in the year following the incident and things, is that there are only like two or three players seeing help defenders on drives at a higher rate than Ja was. And so that obviously factors into it as well. But like, he hasn't been the same rim threat, and that ultimately hurts the overall impact and value that he brings on the floor. But I think if you're Miami, if the cost is Tyler Hero, who you didn't give the extension to ahead of the season anyway, like if it's one of those swaps where Hero's the foundation, you don't have to give up Khalil Ware in the deal, I think it's probably worth the swing. If for no other reason, then we have to take an upside swing somewhere with this. And I think, too, the concerns about Ja not liking the offense, I think that's a valid concern to have. But it's also like, to your point, Steve, it'll probably be easier for him to trust in the pedigree of Eric Spoelstra who has won multiple championships and it just is the longest tenure coach in the league now, right? Or between him and Rick Carlisle. Like, I think it's fair to say that John may have a higher level of respect for Eric Spoelstra. So, like, you can talk yourself into that. And even with the John contract, $39 million this year, $42 million next year, about $45 million the year after that. Like, it's not a crippling deal, and he's only 26. So if he does turn around, not only do you still have a young star-level talent or all-star-level talent, he's locked in. You don't really have to worry about that for another year and a half. We talk about off-season extensions, things like that. So I am starting to vibe a little bit more with Miami as an option, at least more so than I was like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I think the more interesting for me to kind of close this out, and I toss it back to you, Steve, from my own Kelly Eco, as he recently wrote about the John Morant situation and what's happening there. Jackson Jr., maybe he becomes available if a Ja Domino falls. If Memphis decides, actually, we're just going to blow all of this up and we're going to build this core around Cedric Cowher and Zach Edey and some and the other younger guys that we have. Jaren is the guy that actually gets you a ton of stuff if the Grizzlies actually want to press that button. Like, you just don't find too many bigs that can self-create knockdown shots and protect the rim at the level that Jaren Jackson can, especially on the high end. And so, one, if you're Memphis, would you consider trading Jaren? Like, what would the package have to be for you to be like, yeah, I'm okay with this? And if that does end up being more of a conversation, is there a Jaren team that you think would make sense, Steve?
I don't think they would. I wouldn't move Jaren Jackson Jr. right now. I think if you're going to make both swings, what's the push for? Like, I feel like Jaren Jackson Jr. would be more of an off-season move where we have a clear direction on what we might want to do, what we might want to add. Mm-hmm. If you trade both right now, what are you piecing together? Are you setting yourself up for success in the offseason? Who's gonna pay the price that you would want right now for Jaren Jackson? Mm-hmm. Is the question I would ask. Or are you just going to try and go with flexibility? It's a different day and age. It's not like free agency is the number one deal to acquire players. You're gonna want to have some assets in the offseason to be able to trade if that's where you're trying to improve. So for me, it's more so I would probably keep him around and see what we got with that and then what's going on in the offseason.
Okay. Understood. Like, I do think there are some teams that have been linked to other stars that, like, have their full pick complement. Like, off the top of my head, Toronto's been linked to, like, 7 different bigs already. If Jaren becomes available, like, hey, can we try to pair Jaren Jackson Jr. and Scottie Barnes together in the front court? Now, if that costs you Colin Murray-Boyles, like, I don't know if they want to do that. But at the very least, they can have that conversation just as a team to use it as an example here. I think this is where Brooklyn would probably make more sense. If they're actually going to make a star swing this early into the rebuild, getting a big that should help some of the guards they drafted. It also sets the table for whatever the next freebie. Like, they'd be interesting as well. I think just about everyone would come calling, though. Like, Jaren is just a very unique talent. So just wanted to get those thoughts out there, Steve. Is there anyone else that you had top of mind for you?
I, Nikias, would like to talk about Victor Wembanyama. And Victor Wembanyama's defense, is it something I've been keeping an eye on as this season has gone on? How impactful is it? We know that numerically, and we can see it in the film. How do other teams try and poke at that in different ways? And what's the impact of it? So I wanted to bring it here today because, unfortunately, we are talking into the buildup of Spurs Thunder. But I think the biggest thing when you look at what Victor Wembanyama does defensively is just his ability to rotate. And this is probably one of the funnier clips was just the fact that when he's in the low corner, Joe Mazzulla was literally like, hey, can you get out of the corner so we can get him out of the corner and we can just figure something else out? But the Spurs base defense is we want to keep Victor Wembanyama as low to the paint as possible. We want to make sure that he can stay and we rotate around that and then he can cause havoc. And so he can stay around the paint. He can keep pressure on you and put you in a tough spot. So when they're at humming, when they're at their best, his man's in the corner. He's able to patrol the paint and he is able to dictate, point out, hey, guards, rotate around what I'm doing. The thing you're seeing with bigs, they're able to kind of sneak and snake and roll them around him and kind of poke at that. So how do teams kind of figure out how do we move him? How do we attack him? How do we put him in different positions? But I think the biggest thing is just Victor Wembanyama has, and the Spurs as a whole have an idea of what they want to do when they rotate around him. You know, whether it's in man or zone, they know exactly what they want to do. So if we get to something like that, just the pure rotations of, hey, get out. I'm going to take this matchup. I'm going to rotate. I'm going to take this next drive. And they fly around that. That's where it gets really tough to deal with because he's able to kind of patrol the paint. the Spurs guards are able to fly around and they're able to say, hey, I'm taking away the corner, I'm taking away the wing, and then he stays in front. And it mixes it up because sometimes you're not sure if it's man, sometimes you're not sure if it's zone. And that's where the Spurs can kind of keep you off balance. And even some of the times where they just make these automatic rotations where it's a pick and pop, the guard flies around to try and take the pop, they rotate to the next one from the corner, and then they make you make different decisions, different plays. So I think when you combine the fact that he's so impactful and they are able to keep him around the paint, it gets tough. The other part is in pick and roll, Wembanyama will just switch, but it's not their traditional switch. So you think you've got him in a matchup and he switches on to you. Okay, we're fine. It's a late switch. He now is able to kind of stay in the paint and they rotate around him. So he's still the low person on the court. So now if you try and drive, hey, here's Victor Wembanyama meeting you in the paint. And so the fact that they've been able to kind of consistently build that out is where it gets pretty fun. And I think when you watch the Spurs, the key is look how locked in the guards are. You can poke at them a little bit, but if you're trying to drive on him, you can't expect for him to continuously stay in the matchup. He's going to patrol. They're going to fly around him, and it just kind of keeps pressure on you in a different way. So that's been the most fun part for me, Nikias, is watching him grow, watching teams try and poke at him, but there's just the rotating around what Wimby does. You know, hey, it doesn't matter. I might be at the elbow. You get up there, guard that. I'm going to be in the paint. Y'all figure it out. That's the fun stuff for me. Now, very quickly, before you go, hopefully I'm able to showcase these two clips just for you. Because did you see what happened when Boston tried to run stat pick and roll against Victor Wembanyama?
Oh, please show those.
If we have the two stat clips, that'd be fantastic. Because basically Victor Wembanyama just got out of there as soon as humanly possible. And he just like ran away from all the screens and ran right to the paint. And I just figured you would enjoy that. But it's going to be fun to see how teams are able to counter. You know, Minnesota went to wide pin downs for Dante DiVincenzo. Like, okay, you're going to be back there. That's fantastic. We saw Luka Garza make a bunch of threes. So I'm interested to see if OKC is able to tap the Chet Holmgren button. But yeah, when he's able to stay in that low block area in that paint and rotate, it makes it real tough. The fact that they're able to rotate around, it makes it real tough. He's very good. They're very good.
Yeah, it's the smart stuff. And again, like we've talked about a little bit before on this pod, but like Mitch Johnson really is just doing a really good job in San Antonio, putting all these moving pieces together and establishing a foundation on both ends of the floor. He deserves his credit for this as well. I guess, really, Steve, because you talked through wonderfully some of the nuances of what San Antonio is doing to keep Wimby low. I do wonder, like, are there different ways to attack him directly? Because I think, to your point, like teams, if he is low, hey, can we clear this corner, et cetera? Let's try to move him out the way. Let's have a big higher up on the floor, see if we can move him that way. Like, is it worth putting him in action a little bit more than they have, than teams generally have been? And just trying to win that way.
I mean, there was a play against Minnesota where they put him in pick and roll. Nasri popped and Bones Highland just drove because Wimby was out the way. I think the key is you're, I don't know if you want to directly put him in action, because are you prepared to drive and finish, or are you going to settle for a step back? How many of the options are those going to be? And so I think it's, yeah, if you have the right talent, you can put him in action, but I think it's more moving him across the court and trying to find ways to attack and poke at the rotations they want to make. So if you can put him in a position where there's a dangerous shooter in the corner, and we can kind of make it so that rotation isn't as livable, I think that's more useful to attack their base than purely put Wimby in action. Because how would you justify attacking Wimby straight up?
Hey, we got a star too. It was funny listening to Anthony Edwards talk about his shot against Wimby. Like, hey, man, this dude takes away everything. He's one of one. Naturally, not every team has an Anthony Edwards. But I think that is a fair question and a fair rebuttal to have, Steve. Like, this is one of, if not the best defensive player in basketball. Your game plan probably shouldn't be, hey, let's go at him 50 times a game. Like, conceptually, like, it may be more, you can get him involved directly, we can win on the back end in theory. But, no, it's a lot easier said from my position than for the coaches in the meetings and for the players ultimately on the court. But just trying to spitball, like, we haven't seen a defender quite like this. And so it's going to take some unique solutions to try to move him around. That's why the Spurs in his rookie year, defending at an incredibly high level when he's on the floor, fall apart when he's off. it kind of continues on that way. So good stuff from you, Steve.
Nekias, time to hit the elbow. Time to talk some Unrivaled. Time to talk about bucket getting, Nekias. There was a lot of it that happened over the weekend. What stood out the most to you?
Buddy, one, Chelsea Gray is absurd. We're going to get to the overall bucket getting of it all. But Chelsea Gray is just averaging 32 through the opening week-ish of Unrivaled play. And she's been incredibly rude while doing it. Open the game against Lunar Isles, you raise the banner, and she's like, well, hey, how about I just knock down all these pull-ups? And now let's run pick and roll. You're going to want to come up to the level now to playmaking unlock. So, like, she is just incredibly difficult to deal with in the three-on-three setting. You hit the weekend where she doesn't have her cleanest outing, and then you get to the fourth quarter, you get a game winner there. And then she follows that up, as we kind of talked about on Friday, excited about what Rose BC versus Breeze BC is going to look like. We're going to get Chelsea Gray. We're going to get Paige Beckers. And Chelsea Gray is just like, yeah, here's 37. You're not going to be, none of you are going to be able to do anything with me, actually. And so, like, it's been fun watching her operate in this space. But overall, De'Erica Hamby with 40 and 10, she sets the Unrivaled scoring record with seals, dives to the basket, transition finishes, sprinkles in some jumpers if you talk about the entire weekend with De'Erica Hamby. She's just got off to a really hot start as well. Kelsey Plum, 5 of 17 in her first game. But as you noted, process-wise, it was fine. The drives, shots she was trying to get to, the look she wanted. And then she follows it up with this weekend, where she drops 38. And I'm still wondering if anyone told her, hey, you got 38. You should probably get the game-winning basket so you can hit 40 for the first time in Unrivaled history. But she finishes with 38.
I don't think they did.
Yes. I was just like, this is unselfish. You won the game. Things like Natasha Cloud and Kiki Irioff in action together to close things out. But it's like, give the ball to Kelsey Plum. Let her get 40. What are we doing right now? Let her get fouled or something. But 38 and then 18 points in the game winner against the Mist. She is absolutely settling in. As the Lunar Owls are still trying to find themselves. Quick shout out to Aaliyah Edwards. They had 36 in her most recent game as well. Those drives are hitting. Yeah, I think players are just getting comfortable with the 3-on-3 format. It was fun to watch the array of bucket getting that we got over this past weekend.
It's very funny to see Kelsey Plum look at the Mist and be like, hey, it's really cool you have all these defenders. I'd like a screen. Stewie, it's cool you're here. I would like to hesitate by you. Hey, Alicia Gray, that's cool. Come over here. I'm going to go ahead and knock this shot down as well. So just so you know, I think Kelsey Plum has brought everything to the table. Chelsea Gray has been insane. Were you surprised by De'Erica Hamby's 40?
By the volume of it, yes. Like, how she got it, no. Because even going to, like, the opening night matchup, like, it wasn't the highest scoring game for her, but, like, you still see the same stuff. The quick slips out of pick and roll, the transition rim runs, the seals in transition if she beat someone up the floor. So, like, process-wise, none of those things surprised me. We just literally have not seen 40 before. So the fact that De'Erica Hamby was able to get it done to that degree, it's like, oh, okay. 28, 30, sure. 40s were like, oh, wow. This is a fantastic effort. And it wasn't like a high three-point volume game for her either. Like, this was very much, I am getting buckets and or I am getting fouled. So she deserves the salute.
Understood. Now, question for you. Okay. Have you been surprised by any of the starting lineups that you have seen as the season has progressed?
Yeah, and like, this is honestly something I want to, I'm no longer in Miami, but this is something I want to ask the coaches about soon, because this is kind of, I think, a 12 game. I wonder how much lineup experimentation teams feel like they actually can do, since 6 of the 8 are going to make the playoffs, and the playoffs come pretty quickly. And so we have seen teams just kind of shuffle through different starting lineups. I think the Mist in particular has been an interesting one, because Alicia Gray goes off in her first game. And she's come off the bench in the last two. And the Mist are 1-1 in those two games. But she's been incredible since coming off the bench. And so for me, it's just like, okay, this is interesting. Clearly, they're just testing out different lineup combinations. They ultimately, when it's money time, they are still running out Veronica Burton, Alicia Gray, and Breanna Stewart. I think they have already identified this is the best lineup that we have. I think they're just clearly trying to build chemistry with some of these other looks. But, like, watching the reaction to some of these lineup changes have been kind of funny to me. I'm just like, I don't think it's a big deal. Like, even if they don't start Alicia Gray, she's starting second halves and she's absolutely closing games. And, like, these are shorter games anyway. And so, like, I don't think it's a big deal, but I also understand why it's like, well, she's playing well. She's coming off of the top 5 MVP finish, the all-W first team season. She had a great first game. Why are you tampering with her to begin with? But, like, she seems very comfortable with the role. So, just keeping track of the Mist and other teams in general with the starting lineups.
I mean, I think it's been interesting because the Mists like to shuffle through things. So it's like, hey, Leroux, come on down. Let's see what you got. Well, fantastic. Love the energy. Let's go ahead and do something else. So I just think it's different matchups. different teams are going to present different problems. You're going to try and open different things up. It's just all part of it.
Yeah. Early season flow. I'm not super worried. Related to the lineup bit, Steve. I am intrigued. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say real quick, shout out to the Alicia Gray, Arike, Lee Rue lineup, which may be the reason why Alicia Gray was on the bench.
Yeah. Shout out to Dallas Wings. But similar to related to the lineup bit, mm-hmm. Steve, double big and unrivaled. I am intrigued by some of the combinations that we are seeing. Like we already mentioned the Mist, and depending on how you peg Breonna Stewart, her plus Atlanta Smith, her plus Lee Giroux, Atlanta Smith plus Lee Giroux, mm-hmm. like they can get to different combinations. The Phantom with Kiki Ariyafin and Aaliyah Boston, they are having a ton of fun together. All of like the double drag variants that they are running with those two. Shout out Aaliyah Boston, I think second game of the season goes 3 of 5 from three. I was like, ah. And I also forgot to mention on the Friday episode, I got to see a little bit of the Phantom practice, mention some of the plays they were installing. After the practice officially ended, it's like her and Kelsey Plum paired together in a shooting drill. And I'm just watching them shoot. Like, it's obviously, it's practice, so, like, professional basketball players are just going to hit a high array of shots. But, like, Aaliyah looks very comfortable taking threes. And I do think that part is noteworthy. Like, she experimented with threes last year. I do wonder if we interview season, whenever it happens, please get a deal done. Like, am I going to be surprised if it's like the Asia in the first year under Becky season, where, like, oh, she's taking 2.5 a game this year. Still not super high volume, but, like, it's very clear a part of her diet, because I think she can genuinely do it. But either way, they get the double drag with Kiki rolling, Aaliyah popping, and you just don't know what to do. Or Aaliyah pops, and now Kiki just dives to the basket for a seal. Now it's a high low. They're just having a lot of fun with that. And Shakira Austin and Azaree Stevens with Rose BC, those double big looks, they look pretty fruitful. A lot of switching between those two. I'm intrigued by this becoming more of a trend in the early season of Unrivaled.
Well, how much of that is the versatility of these bigs, but also each team has one they can throw out there?
I think a little bit of everything. Like, I think it's easier to say we can go double big when you have, like, Azaree can shoot, Shakira can switch. Kiki can seal folks, Aaliyah can shoot a little bit. Like, I think the contrasting skill sets makes it easier to tap that button. And naturally, you are facing other teams that can toss out this kind of size. So there is just a natural matching up bit that goes along with this as well. Like, I think we're going to see more of it, frankly.
Yeah, because I mean, it's funny you mentioned some of the different combinations. Like, well, you kind of have to do that against the Breeze. You're going to have to do that against the Mist. You're going to have to find your two to face their two, or else it's going to be post-up central. So it gets interesting.
Yeah, it gets funny. It gets funny indeed. Actually, speaking of the Breeze, it's been kind of fun watching them shapeshift. Like, there's natural excitement level around the team because of how good they are, how young they are. Paige Becker's at the head of the attack there. But the way the talent's being utilized, like, it's not just high pick and roll with Paige Beckers. Like, they'll sprinkle that looks for her as well, but they get her off the ball and get into different types of splits. That part's fun. Over the last couple of games, like, watching the Breeze flow into, we're going to use Dom as a hub. We're going to use Cam Brink as a hub. We'll sprinkle in Rekia as a hub as well. And they kind of screen away from each other and get into those kind of actions. It's, I want to say surprise. That probably isn't the right word, but, like, I came into this with an open slate. They're a new team. Like, I just want to see what this offense is going to look like. I like what they're building in the half court. Like, naturally, 3-on-3 full court, there's just going to be a whole lot of transition and early offense. But, like, the set pieces from them have been very good. I've enjoyed the way they've utilized the talent. I would also say quickly, Rekia Jackson, walking mismatch. We knew that already. Some of the playmaking that we've seen from Rekia in the early portion of the season has been really intriguing. And I am curious to see how much of that carries over into the eventual W season. But I've enjoyed watching Breeze BC so far.
Well, there goes the thing I was going to say, because the patience from Rekia Jackson has been very fun to watch. So fantastic. Do you have any Maria Mabry thoughts before we exit?
She's overtasked. We're still waiting for Skylar Diggins to make her season debut, which, as I said on Friday, got to talk to her in practice that Thursday. She said she's feeling great. Asked if she was going to be available this weekend. She responded, I'm feeling great. We have not seen Skylar Diggins yet. So hopefully we see her this upcoming week/weekend. So we'll see what happens there. It's been interesting watching Marina figure some things out as a passer. As of today, leading unrivaled in assists per game and turnovers per game. So obviously it hasn't all been perfect. But And I think that's just a work in progress with her having more on her plate on the ball. What's gotten me is that in two games, we have gotten to the end of the second quarter, and again, 18-second shot clock, and Marina Mabry's like, yes, I am taking a deep pull-up three or some kind of three with like 9 on the clock. And it's just like, why are we not holding for the final possession in these situations? And so that is like a very minor thing that I'm going to be keeping track of with this next slate of games heading into the weekend. Just how are the Lunar Isles ending quarters? Because like I can't imagine that is just like intentional strategy to just give the other team the final shot when you don't have to.
But that's what understood. I was going to say, speaking of clock management, our time is up. Take us home.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you have not already to get all of our awesome content. You can follow me on socials at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.